Yes.
But I don't know. Is it all right now for everybody?
Yeah, this is Steve. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
So do we still have do we have Wendy Backer here?
This is Aubrey. I think I got in this time.
Okay, great.
Are you in on your own phone, Aubrey?
I'm in on a voice over IP.
Okay.
I finally got one to work.
Good.
But these bridges often don't like VoIP, so it's been a problem. We should be, if this one's working, that's really helpful.
This is Vonage I'm trying on this one.
Yeah.
Okay, why don't we, in the interest of moving discussion along, while we wait for Wendy to get back, jump the queue, and Marilyn, if you want to address your questions or comments.
So I just had a couple of questions for Steve. I've reviewed the proposal several times, but for others, the .nl ccTLD, as I recall, is somewhere around 3 million names. Is that right?
I think it's about 2 million and change. It's I don't have the exact number, but it's over 2 million.
And having worked with the Netherlands on the data retention issue, as I recall, they have a fairly strong data privacy regime in place in the country. Did you have any comment on, and maybe we may have Wendy back maybe by now. Wendy, is that you?
Sounds like no.
Then I'll just continue. Did you have a chance to look at all at the data privacy regime in the country?
Well, I didn't look at it in detail. You're right. They have a privacy data protection law there that comply. You know, it's in compliance with the EU data protection legislation. And I know that the data protection authority was consulted on. This was put in place in 2003 as part of by SIDN, which is the .nl registry operator, as part of overall revision of its data policies and privacy policies and so forth. So I know the Dutch data protection authorities were involved in that process, but I don't really know any details beyond that.
But we could assume that it is compliant with the European Commission's data privacy and data retention regime, since all the member states are required to comply.
Yeah, as far as I know, there's never been a question raised about that.
Thanks.
Jordan, were you next in the queue, or if?
Have I gotten myself unmuted here?
Okay, sorry about that. I just managed to disconnect myself instead of unmuting. sorry, is that Wendy back?
I'm trying to be back.
Okay.
Can anyone hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay.
Do you want to go ahead and ask your question? I think we got partway through you expressing your general concerns about privacy.
Okay, the general point is that privacy shouldn't be of one of these, you have to prove special circumstances to get it, but rather the default. But the more particular sort of practical question here is that I think that this is a huge burden and an unfair shifting of that burden onto the registries and registrars and individual registrants. That what can be managed centrally relatively well for 2 million registrants is going to be a huge scaling problem for more than 70 million registrants and GTLDs, and I don't think there's any way effectively to manage that so that people get their domain names in a reasonably inexpensive, efficient manner. I would and to say that that cost should be borne even by some combination of registrars and individual registrants, I think, shift the cost from the few people who are interested in finding out information about domain name holders to a much larger pool of domain name registrants, you know, most of whom there will never be any interest in what their identity and contact information is. So to make all of them jump through extra hoops to get that protected and pay extra costs doesn't seem like a fair shifting of the system. I could raise other concerns about categorization, and specifically I don't think non-commercial or personal safety and security are appropriate limits. There are lots of other people and organizations who would have legitimate and real interests in not having identities disclosed, but I think we can go into those further if depending on how further conversation progresses.
Thanks, Wendy. Steve, do you want to have any response or comments you want to make to that?
Well, sure. To say that there are only a few. This is really about .com. I think your point about scalability, because most of the other GTLD registries are smaller than .nl, or they are thick registries where this is already centralized. Or like .biz, at least under our proposal, .biz wouldn't have this because they don't have non-commercial registrants. They're not supposed to. So it's really a question of could it be done in, I think, is could it be done in .com? I think that this is why centralization, either to one decision-maker or at most to five decision-makers, is essential, because I would agree that it wouldn't scale if 800 different registrars had to operate this. But basically, the registrars wouldn't have to operate this. They'd simply have to let people know it was available. If people made an application, they would... the registrars would automatically be notified not to make the WHOIS data available until there was a decision on the application. The registrars would be notified of the decision, and it would be a binary process. Either they would make available the data that had been supplied by the registrant, as they're supposed to do today, or they would make, you know, some other specified data, probably registrar data, available until they heard otherwise from the third-party vendor, for example, if the person had become ineligible for the program, if the person didn't renew their application or whatever. So I think it wouldn't be that difficult for registrars to operate this, and I don't. I would say that at least in this proposal, we're not suggesting any financial cost to a registrant. The registrant wouldn't, under this model anyway, the registrant wouldn't pay for this application. So
somebody
I hear you that the registrant would have to.
Vendor, though.
Pardon me?
I would imagine somebody has to pay the third-party vendor.
Yeah, I think ICANN would pay the third-party vendor based on the fees that they're already collecting on a volume-sensitive basis from registrars and registries. So, but there wouldn't be financial costs. I agree with you that the applicant would have to fill out a form and send it in and show that it was, you know, that he or she was entitled to this status, but... those would be, you know, my reactions to those comments, and I think I really think this boils down to a .com issue, because I think with the other registries it's not a scalability question.
Thanks, Steve. I have a few questions. One is that there's brief mention in this document of the notion of personal domains in .nl,
yeah,
which I know does exist and has sort of a default privacy on
yes.
attribute. And you, I guess this document makes the point that there aren't very many of those.
Right.
Do you have any sense of why that's the case? Like, if we looked at the distribution in the GTLDs and saw that there were a reasonable number of domains that might qualify for this notion of personal domains in the in .nl, would there be any reason why that notion of a type of sort of personal domain that has a default privacy on option, would that would it make sense to try to apply that option in the GTLD space as well?
Well, I don't really know why there are so few. I think this is an artifact of the time. At some point in the past, .NL had a much more restrictive registration policy, as many ccTLDs did, and you know, any applicant, any registrant could only get one domain name and so forth, and that was the point at which they set up this system of personal domain names. But I believe they were, at least as of last summer, they were considering abolishing it, and they may have abolished it. I've actually asked the .NL registry operator for the status of this and haven't gotten any response yet, so I don't know.
Okay, so they're
only 467 out of 2 million names.
Right, so they may view that. Well, I think part of the reason, I think I remember that there's some, you have to get some sort of unattractive second level domain as part of your domain. So you have to get like, you can get like Steve dot, and then it's something silly like 1298.nl or something like that.
Well, I don't know. I just don't know.
Okay. But in any case, so it sounds like you believe they may be sort of replacing that with something that resembles the system as give registrants the sort of privacy option.
Well, they have that, the system with the privacy option in place. They've had it for 3 years, but they're considering abolishing this private domain name status, which automatically gets it.
Right. Okay. Second question is that so this addresses, I think, some of, well, this probably addresses our third terms of reference, which relates to access to data.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any sense of how our other terms of reference regarding the definition of the contacts as well as the accuracy or improving the response to inaccurate data, how those might be incorporated into this proposal?
At least for people that apply for the special circumstances status, clearly they would have to demonstrate that they were an individual and that they were non-commercial. So it may well be that they would whatever verification was required would help to improve the accuracy of that data. For those who chose not to apply for it, it wouldn't affect the accuracy, except to the extent that we've heard that people who don't want to have their data made public because they have privacy concerns may submit inaccurate data. Here they would have an alternate route to try to have their privacy concerns addressed without having to submit inaccurate data.
So it could have some
positive impact on accuracy. I wouldn't want to overstate that.
So is the notion that we would just retain the status quo accuracy provision?
Well, this I think it's fair to say that this proposal doesn't address that, except to a marginal extent. This proposal doesn't address that point.
Okay, so we would have to, if we were to adopt this proposal, we might have to do further work
right.
with regards to accuracy. Okay. Okay, those are all my questions. Any other questions for Steve right now? If not, in the interest of time, I think we'll move on to...
Jordan, could I just supplement my last answer
sure.
on one point? And I looked through this, I see it's not included here, but in fact, on the .NL site, and I will send it around, they do make a determination of the purpose of collecting the data and of collecting the various, at least in general terms, the purpose of collecting the contact data. I think that is kind of relevant for our first term of reference, and therefore I'll send that around. I thought it was included in this summary, but I guess I didn't.
Okay, great. Okay, why don't we move on then to Aubrey's proposal, which relates to, which you can find in the Rightly document. We're back to the OPOC proposal space now, and it's in the section on correcting inaccurate WHOIS data. Aubrey, do you want to just maybe introduce this briefly with a quick rationale, and then we'll see if there are questions or comments?
Basically, these were the where I put in basically a proposal of not less than some number of days. It's basically in that in any of these things, I know we're saying timely, and I know it's an operational thing to define, as I just maintain a concern that that it not be too short a period, and that basically there be sufficient any of these things actually happen. So, and that was the reason for getting a little bit more specific about it, but not to the point where we actually give a fixed amount of time, just basically margin on the time.
Okay, great. So, any questions or comments about this? I have one, so maybe I'll start off. So the idea here is that is to give the registrant some certain amount of time to respond. Is that the idea?
Yes.
Okay, but if, for example, the registrar called up the registrant and said, "Hey, we think your information's invalid," and the registrant said, "Oh, yeah, here's the new information," that there wouldn't be a problem with them just updating information right away, I would imagine, right?
No.
So it's not that you have to wait this period of time. It's that it's some
that's
minimum.
Certainly not the right. That
right.
Certainly
okay.
Wasn't the intent.
Okay, great. Any other questions about this?
This is Steve. Could I?
Yeah, go ahead.
In the queue.
And I'd like to be in the queue.
Okay, and then Marilyn.
I think there are really two points here. One is, should there be a set number of days spelled out in this part of the proposal, and if so, what should that be? The problem is, I think it's kind of hard to have a one-size-fits-all here. I think the time sensitivity of correcting data is much higher, for example, in a phishing situation where the amount of harm is usually directly proportional to the amount of time that a site remains up. That's probably less true for some other types of problems that might lead people to try to contact a registrant and find out that there's inaccurate data. So I'm not. I think it's difficult to come up with one entry for either of these points that would be applicable in all those cases. The second point is that I think Avery suggested in her posting that maybe it'd be 60 days, and I just can't understand why the registrar would take more than about 60 minutes to pass this along to the OPOC or the registered dame holder, and certainly I don't see why either of those, both of whom are supposed to submit accurate data, I guess, why they would need 60 days to correct it or defend it. So I'm a little concerned about the idea of putting any specific number of days in here, and I'm certainly concerned about 60.
Okay. To answer the two, on the first one, I guess, you know, you bring up phishing, and my presumption is that when someone starts casting about looking for a fisher or wanting to check on the updated information, they're still innocent. And the innocent person could just as easily be someone on an extended vacation, could be someone away from their phone, could be any number of conditions for why the instant contact in 60 seconds could not be made. So basically, going on a presumption of innocence, going on a presumption that you basically have the right to have the time for someone to access you, one needs there to be a not less than time. And I'm not trying to say all times fit something. 60 minutes is, to me, a satisfactory time. And basically just based on the amount of time someone can be away from their posted address or posted telephone number. But I put in XX because I realized that I might have an extreme version of what that timeliness is. So I'm more interested in the principle that there has to be at least a minimum threshold, whether it's 60 or 30 or some number in between. Is almost operational. It's almost taking into account of do you live in a country where people take four-week vacations, or do you live in a country where they take two-week vacations? Someone's away for 4 weeks, as happens often in Europe, then to lose your registration because you didn't correct it in 4 weeks would be a wrongness.
Jordan, could I, on point one here, though, is about the registrar notifying the operational point of contact. So the registrar, are you saying the registrar might be on vacation for 4 weeks, and therefore don't need to do anything?
You're right. That one would be a different situation, and one I looked for, yeah.
Okay.
That would be a different time consideration, yes.
Yeah, I think probably makes sense to get any feedback that might be relevant from the registrars on that point if they think that there is some minimum standard required. But I would imagine that the registrars are probably, Tom can probably speak up, but the timely manner language might be sufficient for.
I doubt they can do it in 60 seconds or 60 minutes, though.
That's probably true. In any case, why don't Marilyn's next in the queue. Why don't I move to her?
So I'm trying to understand, given that we've maintained that the task force is discussing the OPOC as a way to improve accuracy and to improve timeliness, I think we may have identified one of the questions I had, which was registrar notifying OPOC should take according to the explanation I've been given about the OPOC, this is a simplification of process. So there are fewer contacts within the category, and those contacts are assumed to have accurate contact information for the registrant. So I just want to be sure that I'm proceeding with.
Well, sometimes I might be my own OPOC. In other words, I don't necessarily have to have an OPOC to function for me, but that still doesn't mean I have to sit by my phone all the time.
Sure. No, I've got that part. I just want to be sure I break down the steps and understand them, because there's always the exception of an individual, but we need to deal with the aggregate of 70 million names and growing. So the registrar notifying the OPOC, whoever that is, would be one time frame, and whatever we call it, that might be time frame A. Time frame B is the OPOC notifying the registrant, although I've assumed, based on the information I've been given on these calls, that the OPOC is expected to have accurate information. So dealing with, you know, a typo or an accidental thing that's, et cetera, the OPOC should be able to deal with. It would only be a more serious discrepancy where the OPOC would be assumed to have to go back to the registrant. Is that right?
No. Basically, once again, we cannot distinguish between the OPOC that is an individual and the OPOC that is a company. So you're right, they are two different time frames. But in terms of the second one, it's the OPOC or registered name holder, you know, must correct the mistake. Now, to correct the mistake, I have to have received it. If I am away for X amount of time from my contact,
sure,
information,
sure, but
then I can't correct it.
Sure, but Aubrey, I wanted to be sure I understood it, because we have a standard period today that has been the form of practice, and we debated it a good deal on the last task force on whether we were going to change that standard period, and decided to stay with the standard period. So the registrar has 15 days to. The registrar is expected to notify the registrant, and they don't lose names. We've talked about the idea of, because of allowing a name to go dark when a registrant can't be contacted for a reasonable period of time. If we looked at something like that, where the OPOC makes a best effort to contact the registrant, they do not get a response, and we implemented a 30-day suspension of the name, but not cancelization of the name. While the OPOC, instead of the registrar, is able to make further efforts to contact the registrant, does that begin to deal with your concern?
Okay, maybe we lost her, Marilyn.
I was just trying, Jordan, to go back to the existing practices and the previous discussions that have taken place related to this kind of situation.
Yeah, no, I think that makes some sense. I think that there's a couple. It seems like we may, to a certain extent, be overloading this accuracy function a bit. I think if there's correcting inaccurate information is inherently going to be a process that involves something of a feedback loop. And for various reasons, people can be away from whatever mechanism we have of contacting them for some period of time, and whether that period of time be 5 days or 10 days or 15 days or 50 days, it's going to be too long for some critical situations that Steve alluded to earlier. Like phishing is a great example of a situation where even if we set these limits to be quite narrow, we'd still probably want to make sure people could at least be out of the office for the weekend or something like that. So even if it was 3 days, as a minimum, that still probably wouldn't suffice to deal with a situation like a phishing attack or some sort of network attack. So I wonder if there's some sort of other mechanism.
Way of thinking about the correction of information versus dealing with the urgent situation.
Yeah, exactly correct. Yeah.
I blinked out for a bit.
Yeah. Go ahead, Steve, and then we have Aubrey back.
Yeah, I was just going to say, in terms of the, I think you draw a good distinction there between the inaccurate information and something where a different type of problem has to be dealt with very quickly. And in that regard, the OPOC is supposed to be able to resolve these problems or reliably pass on data to resolve operational issues relating to a domain name. And it strikes me that being gone for 4 weeks, if an OPOC is gone for 4 weeks, it's not going to be able to do either of those things. Certainly not going to be able to resolve the problem in a timely fashion. And I don't know what reliably means in this context, but I don't think it means sometime in the next 4 weeks. For passing on the data to resolve the problem,
right? So I think there's probably two. I think Marilyn's probably put her finger on it, that we probably want to think about solutions that relate to sort of really time critical situations, and then as one tier, and not try to necessarily conflate that with dealing with inaccurate information, which is still important, but maybe not quite as time sensitive, and maybe needs a different approach to those two. And I think you're right, Steve, that the OPOC, in most cases, ought to be able to resolve both of these issues. But if we're talking about the issue where the OPOC data is inaccurate, for example, right, there's no way the OPOC, we can't reliably expect the OPOC to fix that in 3 days because the OPOC, we don't have the right information to get in touch with the OPOC. So that may be a more time-consuming process to replace that than to deal with a situation where there's some critical network attack taking place. Avery, did you hear Marilyn's?
Yeah, I heard much of it, and then it blinked out at the end, and I caught a lot of it in the following out discussion. And I'm sorry about the way voice over IP is working, but I just can't afford a dollar a minute for a phone.
Yes, so Marilyn, do you want to? I think you had a question at the very end of your statement, Marilyn.
Well, it had to do with the differentiation between the emergency situation and the norm.
No, that's sort of a point that I raised afterwards. But Marilyn, do you want to recap maybe the last couple sentences of your comment?
Hopefully, it won't blink out in the meantime.
We have Marilyn, like musical chairs.
Let me address while waiting for Marilyn the issue of the emergency and the phishing for someone that's phishing. That basically would seem to me to fall into those things that the law enforcement does in the law enforcement means, and they're not using normal, let's correct the data practice. So I would really think that, yes, that would be different than just how do we make sure that that data is updated. The other one, I keep coming back to the point of, I think the OPOC is easier simply because you don't have three or four different points of contact, and as the administrative, the technical, the carrier, I mean, the registrant, you've got one. So, yes, it is more direct, but I don't think we can presume that all OPOCs will be professional acting in a capacity. I think that the most case, OPOCs will still be a normal person, natural person.
Thanks, Aubrey. Do we have Marilyn back? Okay, without quite concluding anything here, I may actually go offline and think a little bit about this sort of emergency situation versus data accuracy issue to see if we maybe can't frame some language up around it that might be...
Pardon, I'm sorry, I'm back.
Oh, hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I heard Aubrey's response. I'll just make a comment about, and I think all of us should probably do that, go offline and think a little bit about urgent situations. But the urgent situations that are dealt with, and I think I heard Maggie Mansorkia on the phone earlier, the urgent situations that are dealt with, many of the urgent situations, the investigations began to determine the nature of their urgency while an ISP or a business user whose network is under attack for phishing or farming, they're making efforts to take the offending, hostile, attacking website down while they are working with law enforcement. And we all know that it does take time to get law enforcement engaged. Law enforcement themselves from five or six countries came to Luxembourg and told us that. So, you know, while we, I think we're trying to find a balanced approach that enables the person to be contacted quickly. And right now, we don't seem to have... I had understood the proponents of OPOC were saying this is, A, going to improve accuracy, B, it is going to give you someone who is accountable, and therefore the concerns that my constituency have been raising would be somewhat addressed, as well as addressing the concerns raised by other constituencies. What I'm now hearing is, well, the OPOC may not actually give me someone who's informed and knowledgeable and accessible in a timely manner.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, Marilyn. We do need to take a look at the definition of the OPOC and make sure that we're formulating the rest of the policy that's sort of consistent with that definition, or in order for this to work, I think. But let me suggest. I think there is a little bit of there's enough, I think, substance out of this conversation that hopefully we can go offline a little bit. And I've got a couple ideas that I'm going to try to craft into a couple suggestions here that might help move this conversation forward. And we only have a few minutes left, so I wanted to get to our remaining couple of items so we can wrap up this call at the end of an hour in anticipation of two more calls in the subsequent next 2 weeks. So the next topic I had briefly, I wanted to, we've had a fair amount of discussion on the list, and actually I'm going to skip it for a second. Rather than talking about the agreement with the U.S. government, I want to just briefly chat with Maria about the preliminary report, and then if we have extra time or if people want to stay on a little bit late, we can talk about the agreement between ICANN and the U.S. government. Maria, can you just give us a sense of, so we're hoping to put together a preliminary report. Can we talk a little bit about timing and I think you had a couple of questions maybe that we wanted to have the task force address. Do we still have Maria? We used to have Maria on the call.
Maybe she's mute?
Yeah, If you're on, Maria, we don't hear you. Okay, well, I will hopefully, just a temporary situation. It would be helpful to have Maria around.
Jordan, could we talk for just a minute? We have Denise on the phone and Glenn, so maybe we could just talk for a minute about what the what we understand the timing and the process to be. And the, given that right now we've had we have a terms of reference, we've had we're making progress. I think your suggestion would be that we're making progress on all of the elements of the terms of reference. Would that be right?
My perception is that the OPAC proposal at least deals with all of those elements. I think if we were to change direction, for example, as Steve mentioned earlier, if we were to change direction to, for example, his proposal, there would be some more work to be done around those.
Okay, well, I need to point out that, in my view, as a task force member, we have another proposal submitted, and I think we need to take that proposal seriously in order to conclude the work of the task force. So what additional work do you think would need to be done on the, Steve, were you calling it an exceptions proposal?
I think I called it a special circumstances proposal.
That's a special circumstances. What additional work, Jordan, do you think would need to be done?
That proposal needs to... There are two other. I think it deals with all of the issues in, well, sort of. It deals with most of the issues in our terms of reference number 3, which is access to data. Although one of the sort of admittedly open points on the in Steve's proposal is how to deal with getting access to the data that's not, you know, if data is withheld, how like law enforcement, et cetera, get access to that data. I think that would have to be addressed.
But we haven't.
I have a question about this proposal. Is didn't we vote one proposal as being the working proposal, and now we've had a counter proposal? Wouldn't any consideration of that require a vote of some sort?
Yeah, I don't think we actually had a vote previously, Aubrey, on the adopting.
I thought we made a decision that one was the working proposal.
Yeah, I think that was true largely because of the absence of any other.
Aubrey, the task force has to consider minority reports, even if that were the case. But let me just continue. Actually, I need to better understand your last point, Jordan, because you said that I don't think we have actually dealt with in the OPAC how law enforcement, trademark, and other legitimate parties go to the OPAC and get access to the data. I think that's an open question for both of the proposals.
Yeah, well, so there's certainly the OPAC proponents have advocated their position on that issue, and it may be that there's still some room for discussion and improvement on that point.
Sure, and their proposal was?
That you would need to have some sort of legal process in order to get access to data.
I don't think we have closed out the discussion completely on that. Or if we have, it would be important that we do go through the process maybe that we're going through in PDP-05 and probably in PDP-06 on identifying the support, because I know that the business constituency would not be able to support requiring a subpoena or a court order in order to approach the OPAC. So I actually thought we had not yet concluded that.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say it's concluded. I just don't think, I guess I'm open to people suggesting alternatives, just like I've been encouraged. I've asked people if they have, if they perceive that there are improvements or approaches to these issues.
I was just pointing out that I think that the issue is outstanding for both of the proposals.
Sure, so that's fine. So the other two issues, I think that we talked specifically about today are the definition of the purposes of the various contacts, which I don't think that Steve's current draft deals with, and what relationship, if any, what changes might be made with regards to correcting inaccurate WIS information in light of Steve's proposal. So those are our second and fourth terms of reference.
Yeah, and we haven't concluded we haven't concluded correcting data for OPEC or for OPOC either.
So I don't think that there's we've concluded any of the work on any of these things, but there's in the OPOC proposal there are specific
sections that
deal with each of those two topics.
Thanks. That's what I was trying to understand. You were saying there was information in there to be still discussed, or you thought we had reached a conclusion.
No. So you can look at the OPOC proposal. On both those points, there's language that says proposed right now on both of those points. But whereas I think in Steve's proposal, we would have to. Like there's currently it doesn't address either of those topics at all.
So my proposal would be that Steve ask for volunteers and flesh out the rest of the proposal, and that we complete the two proposals. I don't see a third one. I know there is a separate group addressing the two-tier approach, but I don't think the task force has been approached by them.
Not that I'm aware of. So what I would encourage, actually, is we may want to break this down by the individual terms of reference items, because I think, for example, most of the accuracy provisions that are included in the OPOC may actually just be reasonable approaches to the topic of inaccurate WHOIS information across the board, and so there's no reason necessarily to have a discrete set of those and a completely different proposal that some things are the same and some things different.
Right.
Yeah, Jordan, I would agree with that. It's at least potentially you could have kind of a mix and match approach.
Right. So basically, by for each terms of reference, we could look at you know these are the items that have agreement by you know everyone in the task force, and then for this there's a majority view and a minority view or whatever it is.
And we could do that for both of the proposals. And Steve, are you willing to work with others to enhance your proposal by next?
Well, absolutely. I as I said, I would welcome input on it. And I think Jordan is right that it's not presented in the format of the different terms of reference, and that would be, I think, relatively easy to do.
Yeah, even the OPOC proposal, I think, is not currently formatted like that. So, but it just contains the elements that touch on the relevant terms of references. So I think actually that would be just thinking a little bit about the preliminary report. I think that the one thing that I've asked Maria to do so far is to put together just a framework that covers sort of the historical background and procedural stuff that's happened so far, which we essentially know is going to have to be part of the report. And then I think she had asked how the sort of OPOC proposal relates to the report. And I think what we're getting now, I think, is a pretty reasonable approach, is we can go through each of the terms of reference and sort of highlight the various proposals that have been made. And you know, if there are things that basically everyone agrees to, we can say, well, here's this concept, and basically everyone agrees that it's a correct concept. And in this area, there's some disagreement, and some people think this, and some people.
Jordan, there's a couple of other things going on in parallel, and I'm wondering I think it'd be important for the task force to be updated on them, and maybe we could get quick reports on them, and that is the Kiyoshi Tsusura Working Group on Accuracy and the recent reports on enforcement that the staff have published. I would think those could be very quick reports. That would be helpful to inform the task force, because there is this separate group that was chartered by council.
So I don't know if they've made more progress. I think as of the last time I had talked with them about the existing contracts group or the accuracy sort of enforcement people, they had. We had a brief report, I think, back in wherever our last meeting was, Marrakesh, from them. But I can see if there's any delta between then and now.
There was just an extensive set of a very nice report published by the staff on enforcement. So I didn't know if Kiyoshi. My point in mentioning is we've got a number of feeds on WHOIS into the council. I just want to be sure that the task force is aware of them. Some members of the task force are counselors, not all are.
Right. No, so that probably makes some sense. I think maybe we could ask maybe on next week's call we could have a brief item to discuss, since we're not going to make it today, both, so two items from the staff. One, just a brief discussion around the agreement with the U.S. government, and the second, to talk about this report on enforcement. And then I'll try in the meantime to see if there's any delta on the other group that the council had charted to look into this enforcement of the accuracy-related provision.
And then,
Jordan, we agreed
earlier to talk a little bit about planning for San Paulo.
Correct.
Would you consider extending the call maybe for 30 minutes?
What I'll do is try to put the administrative things to the tail end of the call, and people that are interested will extend the call for 30 minutes.
Okay.
Jordan, just one point of clarification.
Yeah,
I think
ahead,
that
please.
Group you're talking about was led by Nick Lockhart.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm so sorry. Thanks. I kept thinking, why am I saying Kiyoshi? It's Nick, right?
Yeah, that's I think that is correct. Yeah.
Thank God we're correcting the record here.
I'm sorry, can we just go over for next week? You want a brief discussion around the U.S. government, and then you want a discussion on the report on enforcement. You mean the accuracy report?
I actually haven't seen this report, so Marilyn can maybe best characterize it.
Yeah, no, Glenn, it's called the enforcement report. It was just published, and I'll post it. You just posted it to the council. That's,
the contractual compliance.
Yes, which has information in it about.
Okay. Yes.
So yes, about that. A quick briefing on that report, and then also we'll extend the call for an hour and a half. We'll dedicate the last half an hour to the more administrative matters, like the South Paulo planning and so on.
Jordan, it's Maria here. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, great. Sorry. I got all of that about the preliminary task force report, and thank you. It answers my question very well. Also, on the discussion of the joint project agreement, Paul Toomey has offered to come online to discuss it with the task force if people think it would be helpful. I know there's discussion on the list about possible effect on the task force work.
Yeah,
so
I think
that offer is outstanding if people want to take it up.
I think that probably would be helpful, and I don't know if he's available in our next at the time of our next call.
Well, we'll check his schedule and send an email to the list.
Okay, great. So yeah, he would be a great person to schedule into that particular agenda slot.
He'd be happy to do it.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to answer any questions if people have them now as well, if you have time.
Yeah, well, we're supposed to be wrapping up the call. If people do have questions for Denise, I guess feel free to stay on and ask them, and I'll stay on as well until we wrap up. But we'll formally wrap up the call at this point, unless people have individual questions they'd like to ask of Denise at this point.
Jordan, it's Meryl, and I just have if I could just go back to what I can expect from the draft report. You were suggesting that we would have against the terms of reference, a consideration from the two proposals on how they meet, what they say about the different elements, right?
Yeah, correct. Basically, we'll just take, even maybe more generally than that, we'll take the various things that have been proposed from the two proposals,
right,
and line them up against the individual terms of reference items.
Good.
And then we'll get a sense of some of these things. Maybe everyone will think they're great ideas, and some of them there will be disagreements.
And so in the meantime, Steve has volunteered to work further. And Steve, would that mean that people should just get in touch with you by email?
He may have dropped off. So yes, feel free to just get in touch with Steve if you would like to.
I'm sorry, I was on mute. Oh. Yeah, they could get in touch with me on or off the list.
Okay.
Okay, is that clear, Marilyn and Maria?
Yes, thanks.
Okay, great. Okay, so we'll wrap up. We'll have this call in the same slot next week, last half an hour. So we'll be in an hour and a half, but the last half an hour is optional and on administrative matters. And if anyone wants to stay on with questions for Denise, feel free to do so. Does anyone have
Denise,
questions?
I don't know if anybody else is going to stay on, but I've had a couple of quick questions about this.
Yeah, go ahead, Marilyn.
I do suffer from being fairly close to this, so I need to acknowledge that. But and when I say fairly close to it, I mean I live in Washington, D.C., and I did make individual comments on the on the NOI process that the Department of Commerce held. And what I took out of the, and my personal review of the 700 comments after you screened out the 350 that were about net neutrality, more or less 350, my personal review of the comments was basically that there were three strong messages to, maybe four strong messages to the Department of Commerce from the global consultation they undertook. The first being that ICANN should continue its transition to private sector, to being a fully independent private sector entity, but that the community did not support relieving ICANN of a relationship of some kind, being called the MOU, now being called Joint Partnership Agreement at this time, but that there should be a date certain. The second being that the community was strongly concerned about the need for improvements in accountability mechanisms and in transparency mechanisms. And the fourth being that the community wanted to see ICANN continue achieving some of the tasks that were in the present MOU, including the relationship with root server operators. And I did note that the discussion about the relationship was a relationship as opposed to contractual relationship, which is what the earlier partnership agreement called for. So I took out of that that, and then I read the Annex A, and what I thought I was seeing was a lightening of the oversight interaction from the Department of Commerce, but a consistency around those four messages. The topic that seems to have raised the largest concern in this task force is related to the continued task, and that's in one particular element in Annex A. It includes, but is not limited to, the discussion about continuing the present policies on who is. I, as a counselor, I have assumed that any policy development process that we are engaged in has the ability to change present policy when it's approved as consensus policy, sent to the board, and accepted by the board. That's what I'm looking for in terms of assurance, that general agreement or support that any policy that is developed in the legitimate bottom-up approach, when approved as consensus policy, and I mean by that also seeking the advice of the advisory committees and the other SOs as relevant to that policy, then gets approved by the board, that it can affect a change in policy, and the and that Annex A does not in any way change that.
Thanks for that colloquy, Marilyn. I would agree with that. That's consistent with what ICANN's board and staff's understanding is. Was there another question in there?
Well, yeah, I guess so. Are you getting other questions? Well, I don't mean to take up the time of this task force, because the task force seems to be centered on the question of just who is. But if the council more broadly wanted to have a further discussion with Paul, it would be appropriate for us to raise that question to Bruce, I assume.
I'm sorry, you lost me.
Oh, I was just saying if the council wanted to have a broader discussion with the board and Paul in São Paulo about this topic, we should just raise that question through Bruce.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure, I'm sure Paul and the board would be happy to discuss this further as well. Were there any particular questions about the agreement or annexation that I can answer?
No, I just wanted to see if my present understanding interpretation seemed to be consistent.
Yeah, yes. The answer is yes.
just call over?
Yeah, I guess so. That sounds like, unless anyone else has any other questions for Denise.
Actually, I have one for Denise since we're still on this.
Yeah, go ahead, Aubrey.
Okay, so you quite carefully, or probably it wasn't carefully, said that that's what the board of directors and the ICANN staff believe is meant in the annex, and with specific regard to who is, that the explicit statement of the policy as opposed to just policies did not have any special meaning. Has this been confirmed by legal staff, too?
Well, it certainly has meaning. I'm not sure what you mean by special meaning. The annex and,
in other words,
particularly the resolution, include a recitation of many of the existing sort of responsibilities and priorities of both ICANN and the Department of Commerce, and including current responsibility that ICANN has for enforcing policies and practices, including with respect to who is, and it in no way is in conflict with the bylaws and the responsibility of the community and the GNSO to develop policy on who is and other issues. And that's consistent with
I understand that
legal counsel's interpretation of the agreement and the annex. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, the lawyers agree here, too.
Maybe I'll add a follow-up question as another lawyer who reads that language very differently from the interpretations I've heard. So, what would be the way, the appropriate method to get the board to pass a clarifying amendment to make it clear to everyone and not just their own legal staff that this is to be interpreted to allow policy development processes to continue and possibly to change existing methods of enforcement?
Of course, when I referred to lawyers, I was referring, in answer to Avery's question, ICANN's lawyers, the General Counsel's Office. There's, I think, both informal and formal avenues to request board action along these lines. Advisory committees to the board can send requests to the board. There's other more formal avenues through the supporting organizations to request board action.
Also, email or call your friendly neighborhood board member.
You
can, I imagine,
do that
any
as well.
Of the board members could propose a resolution.
Right. The problem is that we can get every individual person saying, "This is my interpretation," and yet when some other body comes to interpret the document, so-called parole evidence is completely irrelevant. It's irrelevant that every party to a contract says, "This is what I meant," if the contract or formal legal document says otherwise. And right now, the formal legal document looks, to my reading, as though it says otherwise from ordinary policy development processes continue, and so I'm looking for a way to get the formal documents clarified to match the, I'm sure, good faith interpretations of all of their parties.
So
I'm not saying that I don't believe board members and Paul Toomey when he says this is what was meant to happen. I'm just saying it's entirely possible that the contract could and the agreements could still be read to say that won't happen.
Hey, Wendy, it's Marilyn. I've had conversation with some of the government representatives from Europe who don't have this concern. They may have other concerns, but they didn't have this concern. So I haven't encountered this particular concern. I mean, I hear it from within the WHOIS task force. I'm not saying I don't hear it. I do hear it. But I haven't heard it overall about Annex A, which is broader than just this issue. Are you concerned about the broad issue? That is, does the GNSO policy development process, bottom-up policy development process, is in fact it still the way that ICANN will make policy generally
like new GTLDs, right, and existing registry contracts and IDN. Are you concerned about it broadly or specific because of the particular section that goes into the existing task?
My concern is specific to the who is policy, but the document appears to say who is policy shall be enforced as it exists now and could easily be read to foreclose changes to that policy even through the means that ICAM has set up for making changes in policy.
Hi, this is Denise. I don't understand where you get that. I don't see that as an easy interpretation. I don't see that as a interpretation. And Paul Toomey, the CEO, who's a signatory to this from ICANN, has stated several times in writing and in other venues that that is not the interpretation, the intent, nor is it the
right,
way it will be implemented. I'm happy to get your suggestions of what you view as an ironclad restatement of the effect of this annex. So.
Well, I think the thing I commonly see in legal agreements to avoid the ambiguity that's present in the statement, which I agree is at the very least ambiguous, is the you see you know instead of a phrase like current, you see something like then current to make it clear that it's the current meaning at the time of the enforcement happens as opposed to at the time the agreement signed. Because current right now, it's unclear whether the word current means current at the time the agreement signed or current at the time the enforcement takes place.
Okay.
Interpretations can vary. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I only read things with a philosopher's eye, and I certainly saw great ambiguity there. But that's why we keep judges and courts in business, because one person's interpretation is not another, and so there's really no assurance that the interpretation that Paul and the board has is the same one that DOC and TIA has.
I want to say, Denise, for the record, it's Marilyn speaking, that I'm personally more committed. I understand I'm not in support of singling out a single policy issue. I think the issue is, does the GNSO make policy through the appropriate process, and does the board have the flexibility and the obligation to accept consensus policy? I read this agreement differently than some of my colleagues did, and I would be happy to participate in a call to address that point. My personal preference is not to single out a single policy, because I would think, and there are fellow counselors on this call, that our obligation is actually broader than a single policy, even though we would be interested in the implications for such a single policy.
I was just going to say, I think it probably depends on who's considering it. I think within the context of the who is task force, it's probably perfectly appropriate that we get somewhat fixated on the question of whether or not.
Well, exactly. I was just speaking as an individual. So.
Yeah, sure. No, so I think we may all have broader concerns, but I think at least I would expect when Paul addresses us next week, it would be appropriate to focus on the who is related issue.
I'd like to add that the who is policy was singled out specifically in the annex as well, so that gives it, I mean, yes, I'll agree with you, the whole annex would be interesting to discuss within a GNSO council and its bearing, but I think the who is issue is qualitatively different than the application of consensus policy.
Sure, except, Aubrey, it's in a section that deals with the existing task. But
yeah, no, I understand, but it was singled out for special consideration, and that's what makes it stand out as a possible problem.
I would add, just now speaking as an individual as opposed to thinking about this in the who is context, I think that for me there's the potential slightly disturbing trend is that the board singles out individual policy development processes as they're happening and takes action on them before the GNSO concludes its work, and that would seem troubling, even if there was a just sort of general commitment. If the individual actions belied that commitment, I think that would be troubling,
and
probably deserves an individual focus. Because I think we saw some concern around like the BizOrg agreements about their relationship with some of the other PDPs that were going on.
And Jordan, that was thank you for mentioning this. That was what was on my mind about the broader issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm happy to take these concerns to Paul. He's aware of them. This isn't anything new. Hasn't been mentioned on the list already. But as I said, he's happy to discuss this with you in greater detail. And if you want to raise any specific issues or actions you'd like him to give some thought to before he talks to you next week, if we can align the schedules, I'm happy to convey those to him too.
Can I, Jordan, ask a backup question? If the schedules don't align and the council establishes a call, is it feasible as a backup to invite the task force members to that segment of the council call?
I wouldn't have a problem with doing that. Ideally speaking, I mean, we'd probably get the best coverage for task force members, obviously, in one of our slots, but assuming that the schedule doesn't line up with Paul's, I would say we would certainly hope that maybe in the next, not only next week, but we have another call scheduled the following week as well, Denise, so that might be worth considering as well as an option.
Sure.
Assuming that we can't find a reasonable slot where the task force schedule and Paul's schedule line up, but the council's able to, I think that would be a reasonable approach.
Sure.
Okay. Well, we're even at the end of our long or hour and a half time slot, so I'm going to propose that we let Denise off of it for now and close this call, and we'll resume next week at 10:30 Eastern Time.
All right.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.